pick up. This is April the 12th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Everett Goldston at the Lincoln Center. Good morning, Everett.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming over here and spending time with me, letting me interview you. I appreciate that.
You're quite welcome.
Let's begin with a little history of where you grew up and where you went to school, and then we'll take you to Lincoln when you're finished with that.
Fine. I grew up in Durham, and I attended First Pearson Elementary School to Whitted Elementary School, and from there to Hillside, and I graduated from Hillside in 1942. And from there to North Carolina Central University, which was at that time North Carolina College at North Carolina College for Negroes, later changed to North Carolina College at Durham, and remained that way until the university system with the 16 colleges. I did some graduate work at Carolina, more or less interest courses, and some sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Took a couple of courses in astronomy and some in math, geology, and that sort of thing. It was part to keep the certificate, you know, certificate requirements that you have to do every 5 years. But if the course was interested and I could go during the summer, I would just go anyway. And I began teaching in 1950.
So you graduated from North Carolina?
In 1949, after a little brief stint in the military.
Mm-hmm. What'd you get your degree in?
General science and a minor in German, I believe it was. Sometimes when you go to college and you make good grades in a subject, in the beginning classes, you figure, well, this is what I ought to do, especially since you don't know what you want to do. Now, of course, the second year German didn't turn out that way because it was German literature, which was pretty rough. But that's how I got, because most people ask, why did you minor in German? And that's where the better grades were as far as foreign language. So I graduated in 49, and in 1950 I went to work in a very small school in Northampton County. And I remained there 2 years, and the next 2 years I spent in Warren County. And after that I had 4 years of teaching under my belt. Then I went to Randolph County and taught in Ashburn City Schools for the next 8 years. I was band director at all three places of employment, and not having been certified, I don't know what this made a terrible amount of difference, not because at that time it was easier to get a job if you taught curricular courses rather than just band alone. But certainly it would be pretty difficult to get five periods in your major or minor or something like that. And it's hard to get that, especially if you're not certified. So it was easy in a sense for me to get jobs because being a science teacher, you know, most times the science teachers were in demand. And a science teacher who could also teach band was just like icing on the cake. So I didn't have any problems getting jobs. The 2 year stints working under certain conditions, you know, you're trying to get a better job. And so finally landing in Ashburn was more satisfactory than the previous two jobs because of the working environment. And going from rural areas, which was the case in Northampton County and Warren County, to Ashburn City Schools. Although a lot of our kids there were rural kids, it was a city setting. And having that central high school sort of contributed to I think, more to the spirit of the school and the kids. And they had, the city children had more things to do, where in the rural areas, the kids get on the buses and go home, and you don't see them for extra practices after school, or they come back to basketball games and stuff like that. But there was just that difference in the city schools. And I remained in Ashbury 8 years, and to the former band director here was leaving and told me about this position would be open.
Clark Edgerton.
Clark Edgerton. Mm-hmm. So I had known Clark, you know, ever since he was a little kid, and I was a bigger kid, I guess. And so he went to Durham, and I came to Chapelview.
He went to Whitted.
Went to Whitted. Which was a junior high at that time. And I came here and stayed, kept the band for 4 years.
From 61?
From about 62. I think it was the school year of 62, 63.
62 to 66. You were the band director
right.
at Lincoln?
Mm-hmm. And 66 was the year that, Chapel Hill just integrated.
Mm-hmm. How did you get to be the director of the band? You must have played several instruments.
Well, I studied music in college. I played all of the brasses in college, but my major instrument was trombone. And I also played tuba in college. And it's amazing. I picked up the experience. The better part of the experience, I think, like it's with any teacher, is sitting back and listening to students. Students will teach you a lot more if you just be quiet and get out of the way sometimes. But working with them and playing the horn with them, it also gives them a great interest because they see what you're doing. And in the beginning band programs, you will always play better than your students. But as time progresses, a good student will pretty soon outplay you, unless it's your major instrument or something like that.
So you came to Lincoln High School in 62.
Right.
Tell me about your memories of Lincoln High School.
I was interviewed by the principal at his home, and we had talked on the phone. I came at the time that I said I would, and he was very friendly, and I felt that he hired me, without any further preliminaries. I don't know what sort of references that he had prior to my coming. You know, I don't remember not exactly what I supplied him with, but I'm pretty sure he may have gotten a letter from my former principal. And this was just the beginning, and 62, along with other demonstrations, other towns, even in Ashbury, towns were beginning to feel the beginnings of sort of the stirring in the water of integration. So as far as the school was concerned, it was very much like the school that I left in terms of discipline. You just didn't have a lot of change in classes. It was usually quiet. I don't remember what the locker situation was, or if these children had lockers. Okay. And they certainly didn't have them where I came from, but all at my high school, when I graduated, we had lockers.
They didn't have them at Lincoln until 66, when it became, for 1 year, sixth grade.
Sixth grade school,
then they put lockers in.
I remember that, which only lasted a year. But lockers, I mentioned lockers because they seem sometimes to create a noise problem. Although at my school, as far back as 1942, and this is a long time from what we're talking about now, it was quiet in the halls. We had monitors and that sort of stuff. Well, they had monitors here at Lincoln, too, I believe. And so the discipline was very much like what I had gone through in my school years and at other schools that I had worked at. You know, it was generally quiet. And as I saw things, as we integrated, appear to be less stringent, especially with teachers. It was also with students also. Then the noise, and people just take the noise, seemingly not take the noise for granted in the school. When I see things on television about a school, you know, I don't mean a fiction, but I mean like if they covering something, an event in the school, it's usually very noisy children. It seems to be okay that they have no, we had directions in the hall, traffic moved to the right. And even if you had a class across the hall, you usually have to go down the hall to some point rather than cross the flow of other traffic coming down the hall.
So you had turnarounds.
Yeah. And I don't know whether that, I don't recall whether that was here or not. My own high school seems to be more vivid in my mind, not because I was there as a student, here I was a teacher. But teachers did come out at the changing of classes. Teachers came out of their, you know, got out of their chairs, desk, and came outside and stood. And this seemed to have been sort of maintaining that air of respect and letting kids know the teachers are still in charge even while they're changing classes.
And was a safety patrol out there in the hallway also?
I don't remember here at Lincoln, but usually at my high school they were, and I'm pretty sure if they had safety patrols here.
So you weren't the head of the safety patrol the way Clark Edgerton was?
No.
Okay.
I don't remember what the situation, but you can probably get that information from some other interview because I just don't recall how that was handled. I don't know whether you saw was successful in calling Ms. Davis, Ms. Cecilia Davis. What did she,
I haven't interviewed her yet. Yeah. She's to be interviewed.
She's willing to.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Wait,
yeah, well, she
to
will have a lot of information. So it was very orderly here, and when the principal walked in, immediately, in like an auditorium, assemblies, you know, got quiet, and I didn't see that kind of thing again until about maybe 6 years ago. We were playing at a school up in Lewisburg, and this is senior high. We were performing a jazz group, and the principal walked in, it was absolutely, it just completely quiet, and I was astounded, and everybody in the band was, because here we had 20 years of noise, so to speak, whatever your school said it might have been. And it just seems to be a way of life now, and it's acceptable, you know, there's a certain noise level in the school. I still, of course, don't like that, and I'm thankful that I don't have to deal with it. But that's the way Lincoln was. Lincoln was very disciplined. Without being harsh, because kids expected this. And it was amazing to see within a 3 month period of time from May of 66 to September of 66 how overall discipline just changed. And I firmly believe that students will do what you allow them to do, just like grown-ups. And that's both positive and negative. You expect good things out of kids and demand it, you get that. If you don't, you won't get anything. You'll get just what you have allowed them to do. That's one of my pet theories, which you don't hear much discussion about that from Blue Ribbon committees who have studied schools and know all the answers. They seldom really hit the point, as far as I'm concerned, about discipline and education the whole bit. It's like they discuss parental involvement on it like it's something new, or like it ought to be tried. And that was just a foregone conclusion in schools that I had been. You always had parents, but you don't have the ideal number of parents that you would like to have, just like in a fraternity or any other organization. You don't have the ideal people with ideal numbers. And you always say the parents who come out are not the ones that are the parents of troublemakers or kids who need some kind of guidance. Those parents you seldom get a chance to see. And I think somebody did a study on that and found about maybe 5% of the parents come to PTA.
What was the PTA meeting like at Lincoln? Did you go to them?
Yeah. teachers were required to come. You were required to come to any function that involved the students. And we griped about it, but you know that was expected of you. You knew that when you took the job.
So the principal is the one who said you will come to these PTA meetings.
Yeah, and that wasn't strange. I mean, you know, this was at it was expected. How could you have it? Well, PTA is parent teachers, so the teachers have to be there. You know, it was sometimes the only time you ever saw a parent. At the PTA, and maybe that initial meeting you may not see that parent again, but here again the parents who attended regularly were parents of students who were doing well and not creating problems, you know, other than normal type things. And the children whose parents did not come, that was also reflected in the child's attitude at school and his accomplishments, you know, with some exceptions, of course.
Were there performances by students at the PTA meetings?
Sometimes.
Were they crowded, PTA meetings?
They were pretty well attended. I don't know whether I would say crowded. That seems to drop off as you leave elementary school. You have busier PTAs at elementary school because, for one thing, children in programs, somebody has to bring them. And in high school, children, they come on their own if they're in programs a lot of times, but, you know, then parents usually come out to see their children perform. But just like you begin in the first grade with a lot of kids, your graduating classes never represent nothing like the number of kids who started out in the first grade. And so it's the same way with proportionally, I would say, you know, with the teachers who attend. I mean, the parents who attend the PTA. Have more of them in elementary school, a little less in junior high, middle school, and then by the time it's high school, you have whatever that figure somebody came up with, whatever percentage as compared to the total number of students in the high school. I hope it's better than 5%, but I shudder to think of what it might be today.
Someone had likened the PTA meetings to a church meeting, that the community was so deeply involved with the school that most of the community was there, and even some people who did not have children in school would attend. Was this the case when you were at Lincoln High, or had it changed by then?
Well, whatever was typical of most of the PTAs prior to integration was still in effect strong when I got to Lincoln. They all had a semblance of similarity, without being redundant, but you had people from the community. But those people who came in from the community had some special interests that would be associated with the school in some way. I don't think it was just people by and large, you know, that came in. It might have been somebody from the community center, or somebody who had afternoon recreational jobs and was coming to school for you, maybe for reinforcement or to reinforce something. That's kind of vague, but for the most part, it seems that the attendance was average. I don't know about the church atmosphere. I don't remember getting that too much. In some small communities, that was very true. Because the smaller the community, the PTA was probably one of the one of the only other social outlets that people had other than church. And because that created some problems sometimes. But I didn't get that sense here at Lincoln because, we were in a town, things were beginning to happen. It was sort of a time of flux or something. It seems like we were on the edge of integration. Because after about a year or so here, they began to pick out certain students as if it was a trial period at the white school. And the Vietnam situation was very strong. And around about 65 or 66, and certainly right after we integrated, the children seemed to no longer in the Lincoln setting tend to react with whatever the kids at the university did. My feelings were when I got to Lincoln, I think I mentioned earlier about by being in this educational surrounding, I expect the kids to excel academically. I found some of that, I guess, average like in all other high schools, but I was just expecting more. I thought being in sort of naive on my part, I guess, to think that because you're in a college community that everybody's going to be smart, but that wasn't the case. And that came somewhat as a shock. Because working in prior schools, you had this nucleus of kids who, when I left Ashbury, I had families of children who excelled, and these children were also in the athletic department, excelled in athletic events, excelled in scholastic stuff, and excelled in art and band, music.
So there was a core, are you saying, I don't want to put words in my mouth, are you saying there's a core of students who were good in many areas?
Yeah.
Who were
that there? Seems to have been the case in smaller schools.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ashboro School was the campus actually went from first grade to 12th grade, which was good in a way because you knew kids. If you had problems with kids, you could go to an upper grade level and get his big brother something coming down there who would straighten him out. Or if you stayed at Lana, you would have taught his parents. And so that's the advantage of staying a small school. I think one of the things with the Chapel Hill system, I grew up in Durham where we had one superintendent. That's all I ever knew. And when I started working in Chapel Hill, we had about four. And out of a period of the 21 years that I was here, that would give each one of them an average tenure about 5 years. And I think when they figured out it was about 4 years, actually. So we may have had four and a half superintendents or somebody was changed, you know, during some period of time, which I think accounted for some of the, this is not about Lincoln, this is, I'm just remembering the more recent things, which are things that happened after Lincoln, you know. But we were beginning to get here at Lincoln, some of the things that happen when you work in a university town, as far as teachers are concerned, the tenure of some of the teachers depends upon graduation at the university. When teachers resign or something, it's because their spouse has graduated and they're going somewhere else, which is fine. But to me, and the same thing in Durham now, I guess, I'm pretty sure, in this whole triangle area, nobody discusses that.
You weren't seeing that at Lincoln, though, were you?
It was beginning to take
just
place.
Just beginning.
I would say the year of 66.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were bringing in some white teachers. When I said they, I don't really know who I'm talking about. But white teachers were beginning to be on the faculty.
At Lincoln?
Yeah. And I noticed that, I'm pretty sure it was that last year, the year 65, 66.
Can we go back to the PTA again? Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the kinds of things that took place at a PTA meeting and how the meeting was run, whether it was run by committee vote or whether the whole group voted, and how often. So those, how often the PTA met, those are the three areas.
I'm hazy on the PTA mm-hmm. here at Lincoln. But I know usually that not every meeting, but maybe once or twice a year, the PTA may give over to a Christmas program in late fall, early winter, where you would have the band performing or the choir or both, or maybe sometime during that day. I remember when Governor Sanford came over once to Lincoln. That was in the spring, and the band and choir performed. As I don't know whether that was sponsored by the PTA, but that's when you would get student participation. And therefore, it was just PTA and not PTSA like they are now. You know, parents, teachers, and students more involved in PTAs now, so they changed the name of it. But it's, I just don't recall. You're going to have to get that information from somebody. I just don't remember how we did that.
You had mentioned discipline in the hallways. Uh-huh. Could you give me other examples of discipline in the Lincoln High School days?
Well, one thing, there was just an air of discipline among schools, not only Lincoln, but all the schools that I had taught at previously, which happened to have been, you know, black schools that I had worked at. And that's why I mentioned Ms. Marshbanks earlier, because most of the schools were the same way. It seemed just that after integration, is that we let things go down. Because in talking to other teachers who had worked in other systems, we were pretty near the same in terms of discipline. And if you hear people talk about their schools, they were pretty well disciplined.
The African-American coach, schools you're talking about?
All schools.
White schools as well?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my assumption. And from based on what I have heard other teachers, white teachers say, you know, I don't think that we had any sort of a monopoly on discipline. It was just coming out of the Depression, most people had to work. Therefore, they sent their children to school with the understanding that you're going to be told what to do. You're not going to run the school. Because they couldn't get off from jobs if they were lucky enough to have jobs during that time. I'd say from I started school in 1932. And people who were hiring people, now I know this was certain in the black community, if you had a job, you had to show up on your job. And such things as getting off from work to go down to school to see what little Johnny is doing was just unheard of. So parents more or less laid the law down as to how you're going to act at school.
This is during the time of the Depression.
Yeah, this is, as far as I'm concerned, this is where it began, but I'm sure it was in way before then, you know. And so this kind of attitude and behavior just kept right on through school up until all this freedom started, where kids, you know, when I left the teaching profession, I couldn't say, look, I want to see you after school. You can't put your hands on me. I mean, it was that kind of an attitude. I mean, it had gone from caring and touching to you stay your distance and, you know, don't touch. That's not what you're talking about now, but...
No, that relates to it, though, yeah. Very strongly.
I mean, when I really left, I had to, if I wanted to keep a kid out of school to talk to him, I had to give him a 24-hour notice and write it up. And it's amazing what kind of excuses children and parents can come up with in 24 hours as to why they can't make the engagement. But I wanted to say that discipline
wasn't something that children, you know, like you, sometimes you hear children say, this place ain't nothing but a prison. I don't remember hearing that here. And the coach, who was a big guy and he had a commanding voice, and his this is something that is followed even today. Carolina may have picked it up from over here. All his teams, when they would go away to a game, would dress up. They had on blazers, neckties, and trousers to match. I forgot what the colors were here.
But black and orange.
Black and orange, okay. They would wear, they didn't wear black and orange. They wore dark blazers, the same color. I think, I seem to remember either a royal blue or a navy blue blazers and matching, maybe gray trousers or something like that.
So they all dressed alike?
Yeah, the team.
Uh-huh.
And he insisted on that, and I don't remember other schools doing that I had worked at previously. And I saw that sort of permeate and go on down the line to other schools here in Chapel, and they do it now here in Chapel, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know, I haven't seen a team leave to go anywhere here in a long time. But I know up until the 80s, they were still doing it. Because he took that, he went to Lincoln, and he went to Phillips, and he carried the same idea over there with his teams.
Was there a pride in getting dressed up like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Playing on the team?
Yeah.
Was there an intimidation factor?
No. You mean from other students?
No, from those players to the opposing team. To see a team march in dressed to the nines, disciplined.
I mention that because I think really it had the other effect. I think maybe other schools might have decided to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really pinpoint one down. But I know here, like when a guy would come to school dressed, the kids say, where y'all playing today? Or something like that. You know, they know that kid's going. Or either maybe after lunch, depending upon what the game was and the time of departure, the kid may dress after he got to school. But that it was pride. It was a lot of pride by the students. Plus, they had a winning team.
Tell me about Coach Pierman.
That's who I'm talking about.
I know. Tell me more about him then.
Coach Pierman was from Pennsylvania, I think. I think he told me one time it was a coal mining area. I don't know whether he lived in the coal mining town, but in that area. And I would imagine it was, like all of us, he was from a family of modest means. And he came to Central to play football, I think on scholarship. And my first impression of meeting him, I was an underclass, was that he was a guy, a no-nonsense type person. Because I remember seeing him coming out of the dining hall with his girlfriend, and she was a nice-looking girl. He was a nice-looking guy, and it just somehow, that just impressed me because none of the guys would tease him or say any remarks to him about his girlfriend or anything. He just sort of commanded his own way through things. And that went on. Even after he graduated, I didn't see him again until I went to a teacher's conference or something down in the Sand Hills area. He was working down there. It was prior to coming to Chapel View. And then he came to Chapel Hill, and he preceded me here. And when I got here, we struck up the old friendship again. I admired him because of of the kind of respect he demanded from his students. He taught classes too, but he was the gym teacher, and he was the coach. And I don't know how kids today feel about coaches, but back then, a coach was somebody that you really respected, probably next to your minister, a lot more than the principal, because you wanted to play on the team. Principal didn't have any control over that. Unless the principal had established what
what the grades were going to be to where you would be ineligible.
But he was the type of person that you would admire, because he would. I'm not saying that he probably didn't have some doubts or some fears, but you would never know it from him. He was tall, he was big, and he just stood head and shoulders literally above all of his players. Hopefully.
Did he have any special things that he had the team do that you can recall?
Not offhand. What sort of special things? You mean like?
Before the game would begin, I've heard stories that he had the team run around the field and come to the center and do some singing. And
hey, he could probably tell you. Can you step here a minute?
So it's Russell
Garrett.
And you say that when he was coaching at Chapel Hill High, he did what?
He would get out there with no pads on doing warm-ups. And he used to say, come on, hit me. Show me you're a man. Hit me. We got to hit him. And he'd lay us out.
Without pads.
He made us tough, though. He was a tough man. He made us put the work.
And he was fair.
Yeah, he was very fair.
He was fair.
He played the game. Love the game and love his players. As long as you do right, he'll stand by you. If you do wrong, he'll put his foot in your butt. That's
Coach. Thank you, Russell Garrett.
I love him to death.
Yeah, good seeing you, Russell. I guess that's about well put.
He loved you to death.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you taught instruments?
Yeah.
You led the band, the orchestra?
No, we didn't have an orchestra.
You didn't have an orchestra. Mm-hmm. Did you have, you had teaching responsibilities also?
5 science classes.
Can you tell me about the teaching science here, what that was like?
I didn't realize I had forgotten so much. I taught chemistry 1 year and physics 1 year. Then I taught chemistry. And I don't remember what my other science responsibilities were, but as I said earlier, you have to teach 5 classes in your major field. And sometimes what I was seeing in the paper about some teachers were not teaching in the field, I couldn't understand it, because it was just understood. It was state law, in fact, that you would teach most of your classes in your field. And therefore, band was had to be scheduled at some times that I had time to do it. And a lot of times that was after school and during lunch period. But I think I had 2 hours. I had 1 hour here for band. One assigned period for band, the students who took band. I don't know how I did my beginner's classes. I just don't recall how that was. I might have had 2 hours. I might have alternated. But I don't think so. I think band met the last period each day. Science classes, we had labs. And I don't remember how many labs we had per week.
Did you have adequate facilities?
Not really. Usually it was equipment. Say, for example, in chemistry class, I did most of the experiments at my desk.
So the students didn't get hands-on?
Not all the time. I don't recall them having that until, we integrated.
So it was lack of equipment, lack of supplies?
I suppose so. And one thing about in a science class, if you're going to have a lab, you need at least 2 hours, and scheduling never permitted a 2-hour lab period, which I was accustomed. I was amazed to find out that after I had been out of high school, which the average kid perhaps don't think his high school is too much, that we had 2
2-hour lab periods per week, every week, when I went to high school in Durham, at Hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And they had chemistry and physics. Now, you didn't have those lab periods in biology because, as I tried to say earlier, the kids begin to dwindle down the further you go into school. And it's very noticeable you only got one high school. And so the ninth grade usually is more populated than the 10th and 11th and 12th. So by the time we graduated, I think we had about 135, 140 to graduate. And I'm pretty sure it was 2,000 or 3,000 that started out in the first grade.
Not at Lincoln.
No, no. But the same thing sort of...
At Hillside.
At any school, you know, your greatest turnover in teaching is eighth grade. You lose most students from eighth grade, either from seventh to eighth or from eighth to ninth. And I think that was one reason for initiating the middle school concept, I believe. Because a lot of schools had what was called the 8-4 plan. 8 years of elementary school, 4 years of high school. Some of them had the 3-3-3-3 plan. 3 years of primary, 3 years of elementary, 3 years of junior high, 3 to 4 years of senior high, which would give you your 12 years. And now we have first to fifth grade, and 6, 7, 8 is middle school, and 9 through 12 is high school. So I think maybe the time and scheduling and number of students determine how much time you're going to devote to science. And then we weren't very science conscious until the Russian Sputnik went up then. Because a lot of stuff you would order, you just didn't get. But I remember one day getting 14 aquariums after the Sputnik. That was in Sputnik was what, 56? No. Sputnik was 58 or 59, somewhere.
It was when I was in college, I think, which was 58.
About 58.
Spring of 58.
We could get anything we wanted, you know, in the way of science, and a lot of times the orders would get confused. I'm sure with that 12 aquariums, somebody confused it. So I just gave them to other 8th grade classes and 7th grade classes. Everybody had an aquarium. Had thin glass bottoms, which mean they wouldn't take much water. All of them leaked eventually.
Did you see your equipment improve or increase as you got closer to integration? Did you see an attempt by the administration to fund the black schools better?
I'll put it this way. As band director, they brought all of the instruments from they brought a bunch of instruments over here from Chapel Hill Senior High that last year, most of which needed repairing. And I assume from that that they were following the old pattern that the Chapel Hill High got all new stuff and they just turned the old stuff in. But by that time, I wasn't getting the students in the science department. I don't remember exactly what happened because I wasn't the only science teacher. I don't recall in terms of what you're asking about equipment. I don't remember any overwhelming supply of stuff coming in, you know. Nothing like it was when some years prior to that I was in Ashbury and got all this stuff as a result of Sputnik, you know. The National Science Foundation probably got a lot of money, too. But I don't remember. We had been so accustomed to what was called resource use. That was a thing that was going along then. In college, the resource use program usually was handled by somebody in sociology and science, how to be resourceful if you didn't have stuff. I always said it was an excuse to keep them buying equipment. And maybe it wasn't because there wasn't a lot of money allocated for that. Yeah. I guess. But to answer your question, I don't recall. I would want to say yes or no, but I don't remember. I don't remember an adjustment in scheduling which would allow for labs or anything like that.
So you never did teach two-hour labs the way you had in?
Mm-mm, not the way I had. And well, now that's not strange, because after I got married and had kids and they got to high school, I went to the high schools and the schools in Durham that I had business going in secret where my kids were much better off. I was a little alarmed at the chemistry department, the biology department. I wish I could say, can I say this off the record? Okay.
The year, you were saying the year before you left Lincoln?
Yeah, I think we got about $300-some-odd. That was the allotment from the thrift shop. And when I left the teaching profession in 83, I think that amount at Phillips was well into five figures. Something maybe like $30,000, unless I am sadly mistaken.
From the thrift shop?
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a lot of support.
And all of the schools, you know, they would allocate that money from the thrift shop equally among the schools. And if one school got more than the other, now this is the way I remember it, teachers had the opportunity to do volunteer work at the thrift shop, and they would convert that into so many hours and so many monies that would be credited to your school. And at the time, I would bring maybe a stack of